Oh, welcome to Tribal Gatherings, everyone. Today, my guest is James Ewan. Dr. James Ewan is a research fellow in the Tribology Group in Imperial College London. James specializes in using supercomputers to study solid-liquid interfaces with molecular simulations. Welcome, James.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me on. Sorry for that bit of a wordy title there.
That's quite a nice short one, actually. It's not too bad. So, how do you get into Tribology, James?
Well, I guess slightly more direct route than most people, I suppose. I'm from a chemistry background, and during my undergrad, well, during my master's, I did an industrial placement at Shell at their old Thornton site. So I did that, it must have been 2013, I think. I was working on natural gas-based alternative fuels rather than lubricants, but obviously the fuels and lube stuff was all there at that time. So I did know what a lubricant was before I started my PhD, unlike probably most people. But essentially, yeah, I decided after that that I'd probably come back, do my final year, and then go back and work for Shell. Unfortunately, Shell then closed all their R&D in the UK, so that plan kind of went awry. But they did open the UTC at Imperial College the same year, 2013. And basically, yeah, I decided to see if there were anything available. And Danielle and Hugh interviewed me for a PhD in molecular simulations of lubricants. I decided it sounded quite cool. So I didn't really have any molecular dynamics background either, other than a few kind of courses on my undergrad, but just thought it sounded like a nice thing to do. So took it up. And then ever since then, I've been mostly tribology stuff.
Yeah. So you're a chemist. Where did you do chemistry?
I did my master's at Bath, in chemistry. Kind of semi-converted to an engineer during my PhD. It was an ICASE studentship, so like one of the industry-funded ones with Shell. So I knew most of the chemistry stuff you need for tribology, but none of the engineering. So that's all kind of, well, picked up some of it over the years, I suppose.
Yeah. What were you doing in Thornton in Shell?
So, yeah, it was mostly natural gas-based alternative fuels, so GTL and LNG.
Yeah.
So gas to liquids is the one where you take natural gas. Yes. You use the Fischer-Tropsch process to turn it into, like, useful stuff, so fuels and lubricants. I was looking at the fuels for heavy duty, trucks and things. And LNG was the other one where you use natural gas directly as a fuel, a bit like CNG, which is kind of a bit more common. But you have big tanks of liquefied natural gas and use that directly as a fuel.
Okay.
So the big kind of LNG ships that you use to move LNG around are powered by LNG usually. They use it directly as a fuel. And again, big trucks, you can also use it as well.
Yeah. So what were you like? Were you doing research or development work?
It was taking kind of field tests and making it accessible to customers mostly. So it was mostly kind of taking research that had been done by somebody at Shell and some, kind of some of the big kind of groups that they're involved with, like Kinkawe and stuff. Making it kind of accessible to the people they want to sell these fuels to.
Yeah. So like packaging it up, making it look good.
Yeah.
Who are their customers?
They still kind of do sell this stuff. It's still a niche fuel. The hope was at that time that it would become kind of a major kind of challenger to diesel in particular. It's never quite panned out because natural gas got a lot more expensive. So it was very attractive during the kind of shale gas boom in the States, and everyone thought, oh, we're gonna have loads of natural gas. But then the price kind of started going back up again, particularly in recent times with the stuff going on in Russia. So now there's not much natural gas to go around, so it's not that competitive economically. But they do still have customers who use this stuff. And I don't know what the prospects are at the moment, but you hear now a lot more about hydrogen, really. I don't know if that's what they're hedging their bets on now or not, to be honest.
Yeah. So did you do much molecular dynamics before?
No. I mean, we did courses at Bath on molecular dynamic simulations. Nothing like what we do now in terms of applying it to lubricants and doing shear and sliding simulations and stuff. That's all kind of stuff that we've picked up. But yeah, I mean, it's still quite an expensive simulation tool, obviously, because you're simulating at the atomic scale. You can afford to do kind of millions of atoms for kind of nanoseconds or microseconds. So, I mean, that's, yeah, a very small proportion of, say, a contact in a vehicle or an engine. Yeah, you're still quite limited in what you can look at, but you can do some really nice stuff now that, yeah, wasn't possible kind of even 10 years or so ago.
No.
What tools in MD do you think have had the biggest impact in your in your research so far? What do you think they've in the lubricants industry?
I mean, really, yeah. When I first started, most of the systems that we were looking at, so yeah, I started in 2014, so quite a while ago now, and the systems that we were looking at then were mostly kind of very simple model fluids that were just like atomic fluids, so just like hard spheres, nothing like lubricant-like molecules. So kind of during my PhD, some of the work that I was doing is basically extend the same type of simulation, so you add high pressures and add shear, but to be able to do it for realistic lubricant like molecules. So, and so taking those same sort of, well, what we call non-equilibrium molecular dynamic simulations, and looking at kind of real lubricant size molecules, so like C30 ish, so relatively long chains, and a realistic-ish model for steel. So, I mean, iron oxides mostly is on the outer surface of most engineering steels. So basically to sandwich those together, put a lubricant in between, shear it and see what happens. And I mean, yeah, during my PhD, it got to the point where we could simulate kind of the same sort of fluids that Jason could look at in the lab. And we could basically get the same friction results that they were getting with the MTM, with our molecular simulations, not at the same shear rates, I'll say. I mean, there is some, we have to shear quite fast because we're limited in time scales. But even so, when you extrapolate up from the experimental data, with something like an iRing curve, you end up with, yeah, results that you can actually, yeah, believe, in terms of realistic lubricants, rather than just, yeah, very simple atomic fluids.
Fascinating things, isn't it? And then have you done some viscosity index improver type shearing? That was really interesting. So you place a polymer in the shear and see how it changes its orientation.
Yeah, we've done, but obviously, yeah, the larger the molecules you go, the longer the relaxation times and the more challenging it becomes to use MD as a tool. I mean, one thing we're doing now is doing a lot more coarse grain simulations where you don't represent every single atom. You basically group together the atoms into larger beads. So the first stage of doing that, you just get rid of the hydrogens because they vibrate very fast and don't really do much, other than add some roughness. So you group those into a united atom, which is just the carbon with the hydrogens around it. The next level on is basically grouping those carbons together into larger beads. And for large molecules, you basically got to do that to make it kind of computationally tractable. So for polymer type systems, we usually use coarse grained simulations where we basically, yeah, reduce the number of degrees of freedom. So you can look at very large things over longish time scales. Cause you can reduce the computational cost by orders of magnitude by doing that, cause you're reducing the number of interaction sites.
Practically, you have your laptop and you connect it. I've never done molecular dynamic simulation, and I guess you do some kind of test model and you upload it to a supercomputer. Is that what happens?
Yeah. So these days we use mostly a co called LAMPS, which is out of Sandia National Labs. There's a Windows version. You can run stuff on your laptop if you want to. You obviously can't do very big systems or anything too crazy, but you connect into, well, there's kind of an intermediate step that a lot of us have, kind of high power workstations which have, I don't know, 40, 50 cores or so. So you can run stuff locally on that. And then, I mean, yeah, that's really the testing stage. And then, as you say, once you're happy with that, we then send it off, SSH into a supercomputer and run everything there. It used to be on the roof of this building, actually. It used to be up there.
Yeah.
But now it's all out. I think it's near, can't remember exactly where it is, Acton or somewhere. Yeah, so we've got Imperial Computer out there. There's also the MMM Hub, which is kind of all the London universities come together and jointly fund a kind of bigger and better machine, which we use quite a lot. And then recently we've started using the National Supercomputer Archer 2 as well, which is the biggest and the best that we can get here. Yeah, we can run some fairly serious simulations on those, so it's quite good fun. Carlos next door has just got a grant to run on that, so it's quite exciting times, really.
Yeah, it's cool. And then so what comes back then? So you'd have like a text file with loads of code in, and then you can then make that into a graphic somehow. Is that kind of
yeah, what you do? Yeah, so I mean, you first have to set this thing up. So you have usually an input script which tells you kind of what to do, how hard to push for the pressure, how fast to slide for the shear, what kind of data you want back from the simulations, how big the time step is, that sort of thing. And then you have a data file which describes like all the positions of the atoms and where they start. And so you put those two together, send it off, and then it sends you back, yeah, massive, well, they're not always ASCII, but either text files or sometimes binary files, because they obviously take up less room. And you basically, yeah, analyze those in the same way you would analyze experimental data, really. I mean, they're, yeah. You plot out what you want to plot out and yeah. Hope for the best.
So it's like a kind of 2D array of the molecules, and you can render it to get those nice images.
Yeah. So part of that is so the ones that are usually the large files are the positions of the atoms in time and how that changes and stuff. You basically you bin that out every, I don't know, 1,000 steps or so, and that's what makes the nice movies where you can see the molecules wiggling around and being sheared. But they're usually quite big files, so yeah, you go. other than that, as I say, it's not too dissimilar to analyzing experimental data, really.
No. Have you had any like success in, you know, getting some of those pictures onto the front cover of Nature or something? You know, people always boast about that. Have you done any of that?
Yeah, I mean, the issue with that now is that you often get offered to do it, but you have to pay to do it.
Oh, okay.
So the big journals now, yeah, offer you the prestige of going on the front cover, but you got to pay like thousands of pounds.
Really?
So no, we haven't. We made some quite nice images. It's not just the nicest image gets on the cover these days. Usually it's professional artists do kind of interpretations of images now, rather than kind of using direct simulation stuff, certainly for the big journals. Not for us.
Yeah. I've got to admit, on our courses, we have quite a few of your images on there to show, like to do some concepts about how molecular dynamic simulations can be used for, I think we use your friction modifier studies and certainly your like shearing studies. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, we always reference you, but yeah.
They're all open access, so you can do what you want with them.
Yeah, we were just saying before the interview, I think me and James have we've met like quite a few years ago, but like this is the first time we've properly met, so I'm quite excited. Yeah, obviously, like I've always like talked about you, but I've realized recently I've actually like not never really like met you. I keep bigging you up and say, look at James's amazing MD simulation stuff at Imperial, and yeah, no, it's cool.
That's very kind.
No, it's all right. Yeah, what's your like? What's been your like biggest breakthrough like so far? Do you reckon?
So I mean, yeah, I would say demonstrating the fact that you can actually use these simulations to do something useful in tribology. Because I mean, even Hugh and others were very skeptical when we first started in terms of like what we could do and what was feasible. And I think, yeah, not, I mean, not only us, but I think the whole field has moved on kind of really quickly. In the 10 years that I've been doing it. I mean, the types of kind of phenomena that we can now look at, the size of the molecules, the kind of chemical detail. Yeah, I wouldn't have believed myself, I think, if I'd have said at the start of my PhD what the sort of things we can look at now. Really just being part of, alongside like people like Ashley Martini and people like that, moving the field on into something where it's not just, making nice movies and pictures and things, but actually you can get real useful information for tribologists.
Yes. You might not be able to talk about lots of it, but... Like the commercial aspect of it. I know from past life that some of this must be really valuable if used in certain ways. Like how much of it is used like that isn't published, and how much is used to develop like additives or understanding, or like, can you comment around that?
I mean, Shell have a big computational group that I visited during my PhD in Bangalore. Yeah. And they do lots of similar things with lots of similar kind of techniques. And it is really useful as an R&D tool. Obviously, kind of the way that we are kind of selling it, and the way that it's probably most useful, is kind of a high throughput virtual testing of formulations, because obviously formulations for all applications are now extremely complex. Like lubricants are multi-component fluids consisting of lots of different things to do lots of different jobs, and testing all of those independently is not really possible in the lab anymore. So essentially you start with a formulation that works. You maybe change the additive package or put in one exciting new molecule and hope for the best. And that's kind of that evolutionary trial and error type methodology can't really be changed if you're doing everything in the lab. So, I mean, really what we can now start to try and offer is being able to kind of do the first big, if you think of it like a big funnel of the whole of chemical space, which is obviously massive, funneling down into a few things which you can afford to test. I think, molecular dynamics and other simulation tools are well suited to kind of the start of that funnel, where you're taking a huge possibility in terms of chemical complexity and things and narrowing that down into the stuff that actually performs well for the job that you're interested in. So, I don't know, just screening for viscosity, for example, or viscosity index. You can come up with algorithms to, deform the molecules, things like genetic algorithms and neural networks and things to modify the molecules and add new fragments and see, does that make the viscosity better or worse? Try putting it over here instead, or adding another functional group. And you can do all of that virtually without kind of having to synthesize everything and try in the lab. Yeah. So obviously at some point you do have to do that to make sure it all works and verify the thing. But for the early stages where you're trying to narrow down kind of, the almost limitless possibilities, I think, the way to do that really is through computational screening. And I mean, they've been doing it in drug discovery for quite a long time. Yeah. And it's essentially the same concept, but for engineering-y type things.
So I'm guessing there's two parts to it. When you get to commercial space, you'll have the formulation of completely new additives or completely new chemicals, and you'd have the formulation side of the known chemicals. Mm-hmm. Like, which did you do both? Or
So we only really do the former at the moment. Yeah. I mean, the second one's obviously more complicated because, you've got lots of different things interacting with each other in ways that are difficult to predict. So the first one is easier, and the one that we do at the moment. That being said, I mean, there's certainly lots of scope as the methods improve and as we get more computational power, that you can do the second part as well and benchmark the entire formulation, not just the kind of single molecule that you're interested in putting in there.
Have you seen one through to fruition? Like, have you designed a molecule and it been synthesized and tested?
Well, we haven't personally. I mean, there was a group in Japan. It was published in Communications Physics a couple years ago, I think. And they basically, so they did this autonomous molecular design of a molecule, or a base oil molecule, basically, that was designed to be good for viscosity index. And they basically, searched all of chemical space and came up with, I think, 10 or so molecules, of which like 3 or so they thought they could synthesize. And they synthesized them and they did have a good viscosity index. So, and that was all of the screening was MD and machine learning based. So that was, that was a really impressive paper. A guy called Seiji Kajita led that from Toyota. Obviously there was the molecule they came up with wouldn't be a great lubricant in all reality. It had a lot of kind of unsaturation, and its kind of thermal stability and oxidation stability would be not very good. But I mean, even they were only optimizing for one property, and it did showcase the fact that, I mean, you can really do this kind of thing now. Obviously it's going to require a bit of tweaking before you get it to the point where you're actually designing formulations with, but even so is quite an impressive piece of work.
Yeah, it's got to start somewhere, and like you say, it's going to get tweaked, and the next iteration they'll design it with to make sure it has the right oxidative properties and things. Oh, that's really cool. Are there any like spin out products from your work? Like, at what point is it going to become like a product? If you know what I mean, can you sell a computer program or like a service?
I mean, we tend, with a lot of our work being funded either by the government through the research councils or through companies. Most of our work, well, we try to make everything open access if we can. So, I mean, increasingly we're sharing kind of like, I talked about the data files and the input files. More and more we're sharing those files with the paper so that people can actually, like, just if they don't believe what we've plotted out there, they can go and run the simulations themselves and get the same result. And that's quite a new, well, it's not that new, but I mean, not that there's not much incentive to do that other than kind of thinking you're doing the right thing for science, because I mean, obviously it means your competitors can just go and run the simulations and modify things and use the scripts themselves. But ultimately, if the field's ever going to progress at kind of a rate that's fast enough to have any impact, I think it's important that you can build on others' work. And yeah, make everything kind of accessible and as open as possible. So that's what we're trying to do, basically, rather than, I mean, we probably could keep everything secret and try and package it up and sell it to companies, but that's not, yeah, it's not really the route that we're taking at the moment. We're more kind of, yeah, open access, open source, just let people use it, basically. I mean, really, obviously it takes some expertise to be able to run this stuff. So, I mean, that's the bit that we could probably commercialize easier than the scripts and the codes themselves, but I mean, I have done some consultancy work with some of the oil companies, but yeah, a lot of that is quite directed towards certain problems rather than kind of, I mean, this whole kind of high throughput virtual screening is quite a kind of general thing that we want to make it so that it's usable by lots of different industries in lots of different situations. So that's kind of, yeah, we're devoting quite a lot of time and effort to that at the moment for various different things. But we're not really trying to commercialize it, I would say.
No, it's fine. I really appreciate you doing it all open access as well. And like, I think a lot of academics do now.
Becoming much more of a thing for sure.
Yeah. And yeah. For someone like myself, and you know, obviously we don't have access to all the journals. I think we have a couple, but you know, we have to pay, well, not a lot, but you do have to pay like 50 quid or whatever. Mm. You'll download the paper and there'll be a big hoo-ha about paying the 50 quid for it, sign up to the site. And you're like, oh no, it hasn't got what I needed. Just having it accessed quickly so you can scan through. I tell you what, the thing I was quite impressed with is the LAMPS kind of website, or the open source website. It kind of takes you through step by step exactly how to use it. Yeah. So when I was researching for this, I had a good look through it. And I was really amazed by I know it's difficult to do, but if you've got the will, you know, you could probably learn that stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like none of our PhD students come in with, well, a few of them do, but very few come in with any expertise with running like MD simulations in LAMPS. And I mean, it's probably, well, one, it's very fast compared to some of the other codes, although probably not the fastest. Compared to like Gromax, it's probably slightly faster for a lot of things. And there's obviously GPU based codes now as well, which are quicker. But yeah, the nice thing about it is it's so well documented, so well kind of supported. If there are issues with the code, you send it off to the developers and they'll fix it. I mean, they've got, it's quite a small team who kind of manage all of the code management and keeping everything up to date, but they do a great job, and they're very responsive, and like you say, that it's very accessible compared to most kind of molecular simulation scientific softwares, I would say. There's a big message board with problems and stuff that people kind of usually try and help with. If you ask a sensible question, you'll usually get some help. So yeah, it's a really good code.
Yeah, so you've got some like digital twin stuff. Is it published yet? I'm not sure. And then, yeah, tell us about that and how you like run the virtual tribometers and compare it to your like your MTM Stribert curve types thing.
Yeah, so that's a really new project actually. So that's here in the Shell UTC. A guy called Philemon. So he went through a very similar kind of background to me. He did his undergrad at Bath. Did his placement at Shell with Roger Cracknell. I don't know if you know.
No, I don't know.
No, okay. Well, yeah. So he's a fuel scientist at Shell. And then he went back, did his final year, and now he's doing his PhD with us. So it's kind of, a bit of a circle of life type thing. So his project is on developing digital twins for tribology applications. And I mean, the first stage of that really is to develop a virtual test bed where we can replicate an MTM experiment with a given formulation. We're basically setting everything up so it's modular and you can have like different contact models, different kind of fluid rheology models, different kind of thermal models, all kind of intertwined, and you can kind of mix and match what you want. And so that's the first stage, and then the digital twin part will be then where we go into the MTM And kind of use some of the sensors that are already there, and perhaps start to add new ones as well, so that we can get some feedback between the model and the physical experiment, because that's essentially what digital twins are, is where you link the experiments and the virtual experiments, basically to make them more accurate. And obviously we want them to be predictive to some degree, so we want to take a given formulation and say how it will perform. Without running the actual test.
Yes.
So that's the idea. But as I said, that one only started in November, so it's okay. Fairly early stages.
Yeah, yeah. God, I'm so really interested to see how that'll go and how accurate you can get it. So there's like a few like basic models around Schreiber curves now, isn't there?
And yeah.
I mean, look, curve fitting type stuff. But I'm guessing that's what will be the output from your model, something like that. But yeah, it'd be quite an interesting link of the molecular dynamics to predicting that curve is be really cool, you know, like
We probably will. I mean, the thing with the digital twin models have to run quite fast, because they need to run at least as fast as the experiment's running to be able to continually update it. So we probably won't directly put any MD stuff into it, but even so, I mean, I'm just excited by the way that we can kind of I mean, as you say, there's lots of mixed lubrication models and tribochemistry models out there, but nothing where you can kind of accessibly bring it all together. I mean, our first target machine is obviously going to be the MTM, because we've got, I don't know, 20 or so in there. So we'll start with that. And I mean, ultimately we want it to be modular and extensible to like testing actual components and things as well. That's a nice thing about that project.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing the results on that. I wonder, like, in the industrial relevance of that, and, you know, I do a lot of stuff with Schreiber curves and stuff, and some, if you look at, you know, we put a lot of emphasis on things like the boundary and mixed friction, but if you look at, you know, efficiency and things like that, it's actually very lightly affected by those things, and you're more into the kind of higher speeds, EHD, hydrodynamic kind of stuff. And so how do you see, you know, who's sponsoring it, and what do you think they're going to, what are they looking, the kind of commercial side of it?
I mean, yeah, so it's a Shell project. Yeah. And I mean, I think it's an ICASE project, which is, again, same as what I did, which, so it's part government funding, part Shell funding. So really it's not like some of the Shell projects, which are directly Shell funded and they expect you to develop something they can use fairly imminently.
Yeah. Okay.
It's more just the method itself, and obviously any kind of virtual testing that you can do and then not have to run a lab experiment, or particularly a field test, then you're saving huge amounts of money, huge amounts of chemicals that aren't kind of being synthesized and then disposed of.
Yes.
So anything that you can do virtually rather than in real life is going to be a massive economic and environmental benefit.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's the ultimate goal for all of this, really.
Yeah, I suppose like going on from that is so you're looking at sometimes the breakdown of additives, and we always kind of reference kind of friction, but when you go industrial, normally you're normally more interested in like failure modes, like wear and micropitting and fatigue. So are you kind of going towards that way eventually? Do you think you'll be able to predict like this formulation adsorbs in this way? We expect that helps with micro pitting, or we think that reduces shear stress and prevents pitting.
I know what you mean. It's obviously a complicated cycle of interdependent things going on, and it's having accurate models for all of those isn't easy, for sure. Particularly when for the molecular stuff. I mean, wear's challenging because I mean it's you need the kind of atomic scale roughness, it's obviously fractal roughness over real surfaces, but at the smallest scales, those levels of roughness are important to wear often, and the initial stages of wear can be at the atomic scale. In single asperity experiments where you've just got like an AFM tip or whatever, they have shown that you can get this atom by atom wear mode where you're literally taking layers and layers off the surface and gradually wearing away at that scale. And you can model that kind of process with kind of a stress augmented thermally activated model. So like the same sort of models that you use for mechanochemistry and the decomposition of ZDDP. So that level of wear is not too bad. But then when you've got a multi-asperity system, And as you say, lots of different failure modes that aren't just like abrasive wear, then it becomes a lot more difficult. In terms of, molecular simulations, that so people do look at adhesive wear quite a bit with again, coarse grain simulations. So there's a group in EPFL, Professor Molinari's group. I don't know if you ever
see. Sure.
But they do like, coarse grain simulations of wear with real rough surfaces. And you can look at kind of exaggerated disparities coming together and then forming like a third body in between. And you can do all that relatively predictively for that type of wear. But as you say, there's other failure mechanisms as well, which are all like micro pitting, and all sorts of other things where the additives are going to be important, as well as the fluid and the rheology of that. So I mean, there's lots of complex interconnected processes, and that's what makes tribology interesting, I think, is that you've got all these things that you kind of need to consider at some point. I guess it's just going through those and ticking off best you can.
Yeah, I think you'll get there quicker than you think, because you can model like micro pitting. You can very basic kind of linear aggression models of like friction to like micro pitting performance, and like additive boundary thickness. So the jump probably isn't as, you won't be able to, you won't be able to like MD model the entirety of the lifetime of the surface, but you could probably model, right, that we think the friction of the surface is going to be X and the thickness of the tribofilm is going to be Y. The roughness of the tribofilm is going to be this, and it's going to allow the reduction of the asperity heights this much. So we think it's good or bad for micropitting. Do you mean? I think you'd be able to get there quite quick.
Yeah, that's the kind of approach that, I mean, you're necessitated to do it like that, really. I mean, ultimately you want something that, it's one model and it all works together. But I mean, that's a little way off if you want a complete tribology model, I would say.
I think you'll get there. I think you'll get there quite quick, actually. So that's probably what, if I was working in the industry still, I think that's what I would be looking at, is that kind of stuff. Have you done much work in looking at different steels, like different alloys of steels, and how the adsorption of the additives differs and why those mechanisms are? Have you done any work there?
Not a huge amount. I mean, at the kind of scales that we look at, it's still quite uncertain what steel looks like on the very outer surface in a lubricated contact. Obviously, it's probably, well, TEM experiments and things after wear experiments show that it's usually an iron oxide, or a mixture of iron oxides. I mean, but whether they're hydroxylated or not, how crystalline or amorphous they are, all that sort of thing is kind of, probably dependent on what kind of conditions you're running on. Difficult to capture all of that.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you've got stainless steels, you've got chromium there as well. Mm. If you've got high carbon steels and things that can also have an effect. So, I mean, it's difficult to capture all of these things. Usually, I mean, the way that we've done it to this point have been to look at even pure iron surfaces, which are obviously the most reactive, and might be exposed in some cases under some extreme conditions, and then look at kind of different types of iron oxide, different types of roughness, but in separate simulations, not try and capture everything like it probably would be in reality. You probably have to look at the kind of extreme cases, so the bare iron and the kind of hydroxylated iron oxide surface, and the reality is probably somewhere in between, but obviously spatially different over the surface. That's the thing with steels as well, they're quite heterogeneous, so there's lots of things to consider. Even the experiments, obviously all the MTM stuff is with ASI 52100 and all polished, nice smooth samples. So, I mean, even the jump from that to kind of engineering steels in real components is probably as big a one and as the one that we've got to an MTM sample. It's not an easy problem.
I remember when came in with Costas. I was working with Costas, and his PhD was to look at different steels and how the additives react to the different steels. I remember he presented some of his work at probably STLE or one of the big conferences. And I remember the room being like, uh-oh, when they saw the results, because, everyone's been screening all these additives with 52100. Mm. And then you see the performance on any other steel and it's completely different.
Yeah.
But then the worrying thing is you think back to all the screening you've done with lots of different chemicals with 50 to 100 and you think of what have we missed? Do you mean like, by just keeping that and you know, not looking at gear steels, not looking at like your piston rings or whatever, you know, where you actually need the protection of.
It's a tough one for sure. And obviously with EVs, you've got copper there and aluminium and all sorts of other things as well. So, I mean, new surfaces, well, DLCs as well are another one that we're looking at more and more. So, steels on their own are complicated enough, but by the time you throw those in as well, I mean, the chemistry, you can't expect an additive to perform equally well on all of those. You've really got to at least start to consider that, I think, now.
Yeah. Well, so I can keep banging on about, you know, like gears and bearings and pistons and things. They've probably reached like a design conclusion, you know, in the geometric sense.
Yeah.
So the only way they can go is like different materials and coatings.
Yeah.
And all those have a huge effect on the lubricant performance. Yeah. So. Yeah. Like, you know, we've just hired a new metallurgist, you know, based on this kind of need, because we know there's going to be so many different new materials and coatings coming through the door. Probably. Did you have any materials background people in the group?
I mean, we do work with materials here a bit, but mostly not on kind of traditional tribology stuff. I say it's more on the biotribology stuff. We work with them.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's a big collaboration here now with Shell and Diamond Light Source, the National Synchrotron, called Infuse.
Okay.
And that's led by Mary Ryan, who's from the materials department. And essentially a lot of that project is basically, looking at not just lubricated interfaces, but all sorts of interfaces relevant to the energy transition. So inside of batteries and fuel cells and that sort of thing. But to understand what these interfaces kind of look like and how they interact and behave. So that collaboration is probably the way that we'll probably understand this a bit better. But we're still looking at ASI 5200 with them as well. So, but yeah, I mean, there's so many unknowns at these scales. What's actually there needs to be known a bit better to set up kind of, representative simulations a lot of the time.
Okay. I suppose your tools are the perfect things then. You can start putting all kinds of ions and things in and have a look.
Yeah, as long as you've got a force field that works, that's the bit that describes the interactions between the atoms. Okay. So you need a way of doing that, and you usually parameterize that from either experiments or more commonly from kind of ab initio first principles data, and then that allows you to describe in the dynamic simulations what the interactions between the atoms and the molecules look like, and that's something that has. For like hydrocarbons and the types of molecules we look at, most of that's been done by the kind of biology community, really, again, for looking at drugs and things. It's a very time-consuming thing. And obviously, it's one of the areas where machine learning's really coming into its own somewhat, is rather than kind of parameterizing these models by hand, is to use, kind of throw away the physics and just use machine learning to describe the interaction between the atoms rather than kind of Elena Jones potential.
Yeah. How does that work? What happens?
It works quite well. Yeah. So it's very expensive is the problem. So, I mean, there's even groups, there's a group in Cambridge who are developing like universal molecular potentials that will work for anything in the periodic table. You parameterize it, get the machine learning model, and you can run anything you like. Obviously, it's not quite as simple as that, but essentially, being able to do that requires a lot of computational power. So it's kind of, you've got the first principles calculations themselves, which are really, really, really expensive. The classical molecular dynamics, which are by comparison very cheap, and these machine learning potentials are kind of somewhere in between. You can run like, I don't know, hundreds, thousands of atoms, but it's still too expensive to try and calculate viscosity or something like that.
If someone just wants to start doing some like lamps MD, how easy is it just to kind of get going? Like, say if I wanted to just, I don't know, shear some base oil or something, like, how long would it take and how accessible is it now?
I mean, I think you could probably, yeah, if you were to look at the lamps tutorials and work through it, and maybe send me a few emails, I think it's eminently doable in, yeah, I don't know, 6 months or so. That's okay. Usually, like, the PhDs here usually, yeah, with it takes about 6 months to kind of get to grips with everything, but by that point you can usually run a simulation of something vaguely useful.
Okay.
And obviously you build on that over years and years. It does, there's some kind of quirks to the software and how you do the analysis and things that, I mean, do take a bit of time to pick up.
Yeah.
But in terms of, like, yeah, like, just running something and having a look, it's probably on a par with kind of setting up an experiment in the lab in terms of, yeah, how long it takes you to,
oh, okay,
to get started. Yeah. It's not, yeah, a massive barrier to entry, I would, yeah, say.
So would you need to pay for access to, like, the supercomputing power, or what would happen?
So, I mean, increasingly, even universities don't host their own supercomputers so much anymore. I mean, most, but certainly the way it's going is that they pay cloud computing providers like Microsoft or Amazon or somebody to just use a cloud computer. So you don't need to SSH into a specific, yeah, machine. You just send it off to the cloud and they'll allocate it to whatever they have available, basically. And that's relatively cheap to do, much cheaper than having your own HPC and having a load of people to run it. So that's, yeah, why, yeah, companies and universities are increasingly not hosting their own machines anymore.
Just by the cloud somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Just pay Amazon or Microsoft, yeah, or...
What would be, like, the cost for one of your simulations? A ballpark figure.
It's difficult to say, really. I mean, I think the nominal value of the Archer grant that we've got was about 40K or something, but that'll be kind of a lot of simulations and a lot of quite big, expensive simulations. So, I mean, I don't know, probably a standard simulation would be less than £1, I would imagine.
Oh, really? For
a cost to us, I guess, yeah, a cost to industry probably might be a bit higher.
But it's, like, even cheaper than, like, a render or something in like a CAD program.
Yeah, yeah, probably. I mean, it's not.
It's quite accessible.
It's not ridiculous.
How is it measured? Like, how would you measure the cost?
So you just pay for,
like, time,
a CPU. CPU time, basically. So it's usually broken down to, like, computational units, and it'll allocate you, like, a node with a given number of CPUs, or multiple nodes if you need it. But you just pay, you just, like, top up your account and use it until it's gone.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of model most of them use.
God, it's really accessible these days. It sounds brilliant. Yeah, fantastic. Okay, cool. Well, you do some biotribology as well. So you've done some bleached hair.
Yeah.
MD simulations.
Yeah.
Do you bleach your hair? No,
you've got lemon. I don't know, but yeah, a lot of people do.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah. No, so we started about 3 years ago now with Procter & Gamble, who are obviously a big consumer goods company. We work with their hair care business, which is based in Cincinnati in the States. And they were basically interested in just, yeah, using our kind of MD, non-equilibrium MD models to look at the friction of hair and hair care formulations. And yeah, so we started by, well, we decided early on that we'd need to use a coarse grain model, not an atomistic model, because obviously biomolecules are massive and everything would be very slow if we were to do it all atomistically. So we started off with what's called the Martini model, which is not Ashley Martini. It's a separate. I don't actually know what the acronym stands for, but it's a popular coarse grain model. So we basically verify, well, set up some coarse grain simulations of healthy hair. So healthy hair, kind of, it's obviously keratin, but on the outer layer, you've got a thin monolayer of a chemical called 18-MEA, which is a bit like stearic acid. It's just got a little branch on the end, and that kind of is all over the surface of your hair, and it's also between the filaments in the hair as well. And that's the bit that's important in terms of nanoscale friction. When you bleach your hair, you basically rip that off and you oxidize the underlying cysteine proteins, and you end up with cysteic acid groups, which are negatively charged. So if you do, like, a experiment where you look at the charge of hair, you basically usually got kind of a fairly neutral surface, but with negative patches where that's been ripped off. And if you bleach your hair, like the whole thing's pretty negative. And that basically makes it quite sticky. And yeah, the job of the conditioner is basically to they're usually cationic polymers, and they stick to the negative bits and neutralize the hair and basically get you back to close to the friction that you had for your nice healthy hair. So you look, yeah, I mean, you also wash the hair, of course, as well, and that's usually anionic surfactant, so that's the same charge as the hair itself. And they basically form these micelles, which come on and kind of trap the sebum and the dirt in the middle of the micelle, and then pull that off the surface. So the formulations are usually a balance of these cationic bits, which are to kind of repair the hair surface, and the anionic bits, which are to clean the surface. So they're a bit simpler than engine oils, but they're still fairly complex formulations. And we basically started off by developing these models of the surface. So we got kind of virgin hair, which is just like a clean 18 MEA layer on a well, we actually use a graphene sheet as the underlying protein, but just to fix it there basically. And then for the bleached hair, we rip off a proportion of these groups randomly, and you end up with these like negative patches, like on the bleached hair. And we confirm like that all the wetting behavior was as it is in experiments. So the hair actually becomes more hydrophilic and more oleophobic as you start to bleach it, because you lose the 18 MEA layer. So we could reproduce all that behavior, and then we started looking at friction as well. So we've started to basically, well, first of all, we showed that it was this kind of surface charging that causes the high friction, not any kind of other micro scale effects like changing the roughness or any damage internally to the hair. We could basically reproduce the friction that you measure on real hair with these simulations, and also with biomimetic surfaces where you just functionalize a flat surface with either 18 MEA or with the sulfonate groups, and you can get the same friction. And then once we're happy with the surfaces, we basically have been playing around with different formulations and different cationic things and anionic things and Zwitter ions and all sorts that you can throw in between to try and improve the friction behavior and also the wettability of the hair. So that's basically where that project has gone.
It's really interesting. Your biomimetic surface, so do you have that in real life as well?
That was all done at Procter & Gamble. So they have a colloidal probe AFM, which is just an AFM with a colloid stuck on the tip. So it's a bit larger contact area, and they're basically just functionalized surfaces. So they're pretty much atomically smooth with just these groups on the surface. And you can just, push the colloid onto the surface and measure the friction in the same way you do with the normal AFM. And the friction that we got from those was essentially the same as what we got in the simulations, which was quite nice.
What was the value?
For healthy hair, it's very low. It's like 0.05 or something. And then for bleached hair, it's above 0.1. It's quite a good. It's a big increase.
So when you talk about the friction of hair, is it like hair to hair?
So it's hair to hair in most of these simulations. We are looking now at skin as well. So skin's a bit more difficult than hair to get a decent molecular model for reasons I won't bother you with. And I mean, obviously you've also got like things like combing and brushing as well. So you've got polymer to hair. So that's a bit, again, we looking at that. And also fabrics as well. So the kind of the formulations that P&G use for like things like fabric softeners and things are also of interest. So Eric, who's the PhD student on the project, did a placement with their hair care group, with their home care group in Newcastle quite recently, and there he's been kind of using the same principles to look at fabric softeners for cotton, reducing the friction of that. It is also what you do with a fabric softener as well, so that and it's similar-ish chemistries as well.
Is there like a controlled when you're trying to control the friction of the hair, do they try and get it as low as possible, or is it good to have it in like a range or something?
I mean, usually as low as possible is what I mean in terms of like tactile perception and things, usually when they do the panels, the most favorable rating is when the friction's as low as possible. Yeah. I mean, that's obviously, it feels silky and smooth and nice.
So like that's a swish.
Yeah, exactly. Usually they're just aiming to get it as low as possible.
Okay. So the treatment is bleached hair, it's damaged, conditioner, repair it. And I'm assuming there's special bleached hair shampoo.
Yeah, I mean, there's special shampoos and conditioners for bleached hair where you obviously got more of the cationic polymer in there to try and sort your hair out, basically.
Yeah. So you mentioned, I know the skin biomimetics, you're simulating them with MD. So what would you consider the surface on those?
So yeah, skin's obviously tough because it's very rough for one, and it's very hydrated. Well, the hydration changes a lot. You can't really, so with hair, there's this protective monolayer on there, and that in terms of friction, that's all we really care about. Whereas with skin, it's obviously very deformable. You need kind of at least kind of two bilayers basically to represent the surface of the skin. So you're already kind of, four times as thick as you are with hair. So it's, four times as expensive. The chemistry isn't super complicated. I mean, it's ceramides mostly, with some cholesterol in there and like other lipids. But it's certainly tougher than hair in terms of simulating it. Obviously there's lots of skin mimics out there for testing things like creams and things. They're chemistry wise, they're usually very simplified. I mean, like PDMS obviously is miles away from skin.
Exactly. Yeah.
So like surface chemistry and things, particularly, well, for hair, we've shown it's most important in terms of friction. For skin, it's probably also very important, but hasn't been looked at.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Well, it sounds like awesome, all the kind of MD stuff you're doing. I was just thinking, like, I don't want to get too good because us experimental tribologists then we'll have less to do, or I'm going to have to retrain and learn the LAMP software. Come and work for you.
I don't think we'll put anyone out of a job anytime soon. It's always nice to have both. I mean, you can never, I mean, as I say, there's always a healthy skepticism to modeling in general. And I think it's got less skeptical as more and more people have been doing it and showing like useful results, and also like people reproducing other people's results as well. That's an important part. I think there's always going to be a need to run experiments as well, and not doing it personally, but I do enjoy kind of overseeing those experiments as well.
Well, if you think about, it's going to grow. If you think about like what's going to be important in development in the future, well, it's clearly like machine learning and MD and more of the hard innovation work being done in a computer in some way, some fashion, less of running 1,000 different friction tests, is anything to reduce that kind of burden.
Yeah.
And it allow you to do a lot of, if you ever talk to like statisticians in formulations and things, if you're formulated an oil, what they actually want you to do is to run like tens of, time was no object, they'd want you to run tens of thousands of tests with all these wacky changes to formulations, but inevitably you've somehow got to get that down to, 30.
You can't afford to run, yeah.
So if you can like run it in a computer very quickly at lower cost, it's going to really help development, especially in this kind of formulation understanding space. And for me, the educational courses, like they're very good, like put in just, some more of the simple stuff you do is just the shearing and the polymers and things. It's very good to help people understand.
They
have it visually, and sometimes we do, like you say, the artist representation of it is good, but your MD pictures as well are fantastic. So we do reference you quite often in some of the courses we give. Okay, cool. Yeah, what do you do for fun?
My main interest outside science and engineering is sport, really. During the summer I play cricket for my local team.
What's it called?
British Stoke Cricket Club, of course. Oh. So they're down in the southwest.
Big up the boys down there.
Yeah. So just been promoted into the A division, which is second highest division in Devon. So it's quite a big step up, but we'll see how we get on.
Are you fast or a spin bowler?
No, not much bowling, just batting really.
Batting.
Yeah. I'd love to be able to bowl, but no, it's not my thing, unfortunately.
Yeah, where are you in the kind of in the order of bats?
I usually open up.
Oh, okay. Yeah, pretty good then.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that, but somebody's got to do it.
Yeah. Well, how often do you train?
I mean, yeah, once or twice a week. We're not big trainers, to be honest.
Do you do anything else for fun?
Well, and rugby as well as my other
sport.
Well, not play anymore. So I've started reffing this season.
Oh, okay.
Which I've actually, well, yeah, reasonably enjoyed.
Fifteens, like four.
Yeah. I've done some tens as well for school stuff as which is actually, I think, a better game, to be honest.
Bit
more space on the pitch.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, enjoy that as well. Obviously, you've got to start at the bottom with some fairly terrible games of rugby, but yeah, hope with any luck, be doing something semi-decent sometime soon.
What was your position when you played?
I used to play at scrum half.
You're quite a tall scrum half.
Yeah, no, I used to be a lot shorter I haven't played since Colts, so quite a while now. But yeah, still enjoy watching and now reffing.
I play touch. It's a brilliant thing to get into.
A lot of people, there's a big club at Exeter who do it. I have considered it.
It's so much fun. It's like five-a-side football, but like rugby, and you just get the ball constantly running hard. It's really fun.
Yeah.
I recommend it.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Okay, cool. Well, yeah, we do this feature called Desert Island Pin on Disc, like the Radio 4 Desert Island Disc. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to maroon you on a desert island, but this desert island has a tribology lab. You can take one test rig or like computational. I don't know what you might want to take, but it's quite open to interpretation, these rules. For the rest of your days. So what would you like to take to your desert island?
I'd probably say the ETM. So that was kind of the first set of experiments that we tried to compare against was when Jason was first working with the prototype version of the ETM in the lab, which was nothing like you see the nice swish boxed up version you got now, but it was just wires and motors and things everywhere.
So the high pressure
pressure one. I mean, it's quite impressive the pressures that you can get up to just with steel contacts. Obviously it was mostly for the ZDDP work, where to get the pressures that you need to break ZDDP down without kind of asperity contact, you needed like several gigapascals, which you could only get in the MTM with tungsten carbide, which isn't the most used surface because it's quite expensive. the thing with the ETM was ramping up the load so you could get pressures that were of the same level but with normal steel. And they eventually managed to do it, and it was quite kind of as a computational person, it was quite impressive to see the kind of evolutions of it and finally getting it working.
Yeah, the mechanochemistry thing is it's quite accepted now, but back then it's quite interesting steps with Jason's work. And were you involved with some of that?
With some of Jason's stuff. Yeah. Not the first paper, but after that. So when they started using the ETM rather than the MTM, that's when I started.
Well, fantastic. Well, it's yours. I think that might be the first one we've got on the island, the first ETM. I think Alex and Matt took a the high speed EHD.
Okay.
There's a nano indenter.
Yeah.
I can't remember what else we've got. Yeah, but it's yours. It's yours for the rest of your days. Okay, cool. Is there anything you'd like to plug or say before we sign off? Where you presenting next? What you got? Papers? You got any vacancies?
Yeah, we got a lot. Yeah, lots of papers coming up. But yeah, I don't think we're talking until few people going to STLE, that'll be the next thing. Not me personally this time, unfortunately, but Danielle will be there.
Yeah.
Not much to plug, to be honest.
No? You recruiting any PhDs?
Not at the moment, no. Yeah. It's the wrong time of year for that, really. I mean, we've got a lot just started. Yeah, it'll be September time again until we got more projects. But got a few new ones this year, so... Yeah.
We've got Roshan's STLE student chapter
Not sure what time of year. Yeah, it's obviously stuff going on all year round these days.
Yeah,
it's obviously Esslingen just been, and then it'll be all the summer ones.
Yeah,
it's no WTC or ITC this year, is there?
No, got to rest from those ones. Cool. All right. Cool. Well, if you're happy,
yeah.
Thank you so much, James. Yeah, like I said, the first time I probably sat down and had a good chat to you. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no worries.
Really impressed with your work, mate. And just keep it going. Keep doing what you're doing. Really like it.
Thank you.
That's all right. Cheers,
see you
everyone.
Soon. Cheers. Bye.
Bye.